I think it's probably fair to say that the only thing that bears a direct resemblance to what was written originally is the title, because when Peter spoke with me originally about speaking tonight and what would be a good thing to speak about, that must be nearly 2 months ago or even longer, and I said, well, I'll be doing most of the preparation for this, or at least the reading and the preparation for this, when I'm next going on a trip. One of the troubles about being 6 feet five is that when you travel on a limited travel budget, as most of us do, and you have to travel in the same part of the aeroplane as those who wear thongs, you have to travel folded up when you're my height. But going to Boston and back presents about 25 hours that can either be viewed as torture or an opportunity to do something useful, and I view it as something, an opportunity to do something useful. So most of this happened going over there and back, and during the course of the many hours I was variously asked what I did. Was I a church pastor? Was I Greek? Because at that stage I was actually looking at something in the Greek Testament. Did I believe in euthanasia? And it's very interesting when you're actually reading on a topic like this, on international airlines, the opportunities there are to talk. Anyway, so the title is Care When There Is No Cure. And one of the things that's very clearly on view in the politics of our rapidly approaching federal election and the fallout from the state politics that's happening at the moment is that the value of human life, the high view that we have of the value of human life in our community, is very, very evident. And consequences occur when shortcomings become evident. And the day that I went to Boston, the Royal North Shore Hospital hit the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald, and it stayed there the entire week I was in Boston, and was replaced, I think, by Liverpool Hospital the day after I came back, and some other unfortunate hospital. And a lot of that was perceived as shortcomings within what we would understand the duty of people that are working in a healthcare and a hospital situation to care for people who are in strife. And the lawyers expressed this within the idea of the duty of care, which is one of those legal concepts that started way back in the common law, looking after your neighbour, and has somehow morphed into million-dollar settlements involving doctors and medical care organisations. But I asked myself, in thinking about this, where did the idea of the value of caring for human life come from? Because in fact, the value of caring when there is no cure is a particularly strong focus of our high value in this country, the value of human life. It certainly did not come from traditional Roman society. Pliny the Elder, who was slightly younger than the Lord, in translation said something like, "It is ridiculous to think that a supreme being," and there is in fact a parenthesis at that point that says, "if such exists," "cares about human affairs." And he went on to ruminate that suicide is the greatest advantage he has given a man amidst all the great drawbacks of life. Pliny was talking about the problems of sickness, the problems of personal disaster in your marriage relationships or in your political life or even on the battlefield, and as was current in the Roman world in those days and much of the Greek culture in those days, suicide was a great way out. And Pliny's logic was very curious. Pliny's logic was that man actually had an advantage over God, because there was one thing that God couldn't do, in Pliny's view, and God could not commit suicide, but mankind could. And in fact, that view of the way out when you're surrounded by insurmountable problems, and Pliny included in his list of reasons for suicide kidney stones, intractable headache, nagging wives. I know it's politically incorrect to mention such things nowadays, but there's a whole range of things, some of which were sickness and some of which weren't, that actually illustrated that the value of life was not wonderfully such when the chips were down. In ancient Greece and Rome, there was no uniformity about any idea of the value of human life. Autonomy was important, but for many people, philosophically, life was like a station. The word, in fact, they used was "pura," and it could be used of a soldier sitting there guarding his little station, and he sat inside his station and he stayed there while the orders came down from above and went out again. But the other way that a Fuhrer could be viewed was that if the soldier happened to capture a prisoner, then the prisoner got stuck in the Fuhrer and the soldier stood at the door on guard. And Plato in particular saw that in his view life was like a station, a combat station, from which the soul could be reduced or could be released in death from the body that was the Fuhrer. So depending on whether your life was good or bad, your station was either the place that you were placed into work and you had your job, or it was the body within which you were imprisoned from which your soul could be released by death. And there was certainly no view in ancient Greece or Rome of life in itself having intrinsic value. Now, one of the things that you also do on long airplane trips when life becomes totally boring and middle-aged women cease to bring you food and drink and various other things to relieve your discomfort, or alternatively cause further discomfort by having to climb over people and go to those little cabinets at the back, is that they show these dreadful movies that go around and around and around and around and around. And one of the movies that I accidentally watched about the first 10 minutes of was called 300, and it's not about Mitsubishis, it's about Sparta. And the very first scene in 300 is about infanticide. And the Spartans, amongst some of their other more interesting customs, discarded and killed newborn infants who were less than perfect. Did they not? They also, incidentally, did practice euthanasia of people who were no longer considered to be of value within their culture. It was a very military culture, and I'm told the rest of the film 300 is a very gory film, but I didn't watch it. One of the alternatives was Amazing Grace, and I watched that twice to try and understand what it was talking about, and then I had to buy the book to get the details. But there you go. Classically, in Greek culture, there was, however, the Hippocratic corpus of texts talking about medical practice in antiquity, and there was in fact a Hippocratic oath. And because I graduated from Sydney University in 1978, in those days we still did recite the Hippocratic oath at graduation, which seems incredible, but the Hippocratic oath solemnly promises, and I'm sure most of my mates have now broken these promises, promises that we will not poison patients, that we will not procure abortions, that we will not cut for the stone, which I take it was removing bladder stones, and it was clearly not something that was kept in antiquity, because physicians in antiquity were often accused of at least one, if not all three, of those things. And in fact, the role of the physician in the original ancient world was to relieve the sufferings of the sick to the extent that they could, to try and reduce the violence of disease, and specifically to refuse to treat those who are at risk of being overwhelmed by the disease. In fact, in the ancient world, it was considered highly unethical to treat people for whom there was no hope of recovery. It was considered that you were taking their money under false pretenses, and even if you weren't taking their money under false pretenses, you were doing or trying to do something that you couldn't do. Contrast that with the view of people and the value of life in ancient Judaism in the Old Testament. Clearly, in the Old Testament, in Genesis, we read that man is created in God's image, and after the flood, when God blesses Noah and his sons before they get into the vineyard and hit the grappa, in an earlier verse, God says to Noah, "For your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man, from his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. And that, I take it, is the root of where our culture at the moment's high view of the value of human life comes from. It comes from the revelation of God in Genesis to mankind that we, you and I, are made in God's image. However imperfectly, or wrinkly, or grey, or confused that image is, we're made in God's image. And it's very clear in the Old Testament that God alone gives life and death. In the Song of Moses, and the prophets always were given to singing great songs just before they went to the top of Mount Nebo or whatever they did. In Moses' final song, he says, "See now that I," that is to say God, "even I am he, there is no God beside me, I kill and I make alive, I wound and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand." And later in also in Deuteronomy, when Moses is telling God's people to choose God's blessings, one of the many blessings that he asks the people of Israel to choose is the blessing of life in obedience to God. And he says, if you choose this, you'll be greatly blessed. Your families will be blessed, your olive groves will be blessed, your herds will be blessed. And he also tells the Jews that they will lend to many and borrow from few. And that certainly came to pass. Elsewhere in the rest of the Old Testament, though, if we consider right through the corpus of the Old Testament, was there ever a time that death was seen as a way to escape suffering in the Old Testament? And if you read through the Old Testament, the number of suicides recorded in the Old Testament as a means of escaping suffering, for whatever reason, there are in fact, I think, only five suicides in the entire Old Testament. There's Abimelech. Now, we had a sermon on Abimelech in our church only about 5 weeks ago, because we were preaching our way through the Judges, which is a pretty terrible part of the Bible to preach through. But Abimelech was an illegitimate son of Gideon, that's right, thank you. So many names. An illegitimate son of Gideon who became a judge and was given to fighting and carrying on and besieging cities. And he met his end because he was besieging a particular city and a woman grabbed an upper millstone and leant over the wall and dropped it on his cranium and crushed the back of his head. And he had enough strength left to ask his armor bearer to kill him, lest it be said that a woman killed him. And his armor bearer ran him through and he died. Samson died because when he was in captivity, his hair having grown again after his episode with Delilah, was called out by the great ones of the Philistines to make sport for them, and he asked to lean so he could feel the two pillars of the house that the whole house rested on, and he brought down the whole house. And 3,000 people sitting on the roof and all the people inside. Saul, in his last battle, was sorely pressed upon and wounded by the people around him, by the archers, and he said to his armor bearer, "Run me through, lest these uncircumcised fellows kill me and make sport of me." And depending on which story you believe, the person who went to David and claimed to have done it, or his armor bearer, he also suicided in battle. The Old Testament only records two other suicides. One was Ahithophel, who was David's counselor, and he sided with Absalom, and Absalom didn't take his advice, and Ahithophel could see that Absalom was going to lose the battle with David, so he went home and hanged himself. Zimri was a king who lasted 3 months, and when he saw that he was about to be defeated by the next 6 months king of Israel, he burned the palace in Samaria over his head and it collapsed on him. And the other suicide, technically not in the Old Testament but in the New, is of course Judas, after he betrayed the Lord. Many people in the Old Testament asked to die. Many great ones in desperation at various times in their lives asked to die, but none of them chose to suicide. And the list includes Moses and Elijah, Job, Jeremiah, and Jonah, but none chose to suicide. And I think it's a mark of the high view that the Jews held of life in the image of God, that they had a horror of suicide, and still do to this day, as a way out of escaping suffering or calamity of any description. Jesus, of course, when he came, had a completely different view of death than was current in most of the Old Testament. Jesus encouraged us not to fear those who can only kill the body. He said we should be much more afraid of those who can kill the soul in Matthew 10. Jesus assured us of life after death. I'm the resurrection and the life in John 11. Jesus assures us that he holds his followers secure and holds us in the palm of his hand. And Jesus promises that he goes to prepare a place for us after we die, and he'll return and take us to himself in John 14. And Christians, starting with Paul, develop the idea that death is not the end of things. Death is a gateway for those who follow Christ into a better and a fuller life that cannot separate us from Jesus in any way. Romans chapter 8. In 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about being away from the body here, but at home with the Lord. And in Philippians 1, he says he's sorely pressed. He can't make up his mind whether it's better to be here and away from the Lord or with the Lord after death. But he says, nevertheless, that's not to be a shortcut. We're here when we're here. And Christians following on from that, Ambrose in the 2nd century, commentating on that verse, says to the just, death is a harbour of rest. To the guilty, it is counted a shipwreck. And Chrysostom, John Chrysostom, whose sermons and prayers were so nice that they called him he of the golden mouth, which is what Chrysostom means, he said in commentating on Colossians 3, we can take joy in the death of the righteous. So in Christian thinking and in Jewish thinking, there is both a high view of life, there is a view of death as being a transition to an even better life, but there is a view that we don't go there quickly. Because also in those times, there was a lot of suffering and martyrdom, was there not, particularly in the first couple of centuries. Jesus said, when they persecute you, flee to the mountains. Matthew 10. In James, with suffering, and in the context sometimes of martyrdom, people are urged to endure, like Job, to cope with suffering. In 1 Peter 4, Peter urges the believers to entrust themselves to God. And in the early church, suffering was there to be confronted and endured. And if the suffering was a political suffering and martyrdom was there, there was only an allowance to confront martyrdom in faith and death by that way if there was no other way out possible. No other way out possible. If you read in the early church, it's very clear that the early church fathers and mothers encouraged people to escape persecution if they could, and only to embrace martyrdom if there was absolutely no other way out. In the New Testament, looking at the experience of illness, Jesus heals. Jesus seems to indicate on more than one occasion that sickness is a result of evil, but it's not necessarily at all a result of personal evil. You remember they brought the man blind to him, and some of the people standing around said to Jesus to test him, who sinned, this man or his mother? And maybe they knew about certain illnesses of parents that can cause blindness in children. Maybe they were just asking the question. Jesus said, no, it was not that this man sinned. It was that God's glory would be displayed in his healing. Jesus also spoke about caring for brothers and sisters within the Christian community as if caring for Jesus himself. And there's those words, I was sick and you came and visited me. I was in prison and you cared for me. And the righteous, the sheep, on the right-hand side, not exactly an electoral text, but there we are. The goats went to the left, didn't they? The sheep on the right hand said, but when did we do it, Lord? When did we do it? And Jesus said, to the extent that you did it to the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did it to me. Yet we also see in the New Testament that good people are not always healed. Paul's thorn, Paul's weakness, Paul's asthenia was given to him to be born. And clearly, as you read the New Testament, and particularly as you read Luke and Acts, which are written by a physician, it's clear that both physical and spiritual factors are in view in dealing with illness in the New Testament and the period afterwards. So how did people in the early church deal with illness? Because mostly, when you were crook in the 1st, 2nd and 3rd century, there was no cure. There wasn't a way out. How did Christians deal with it? Well, in the 3rd century, there were significant episodes of plagues right around the Mediterranean, and the Christians were known for caring for those who were affected without regard for their own lives. In the 4th century, one of the many basils of the early church, the Basil in Cappadocia, organised a complex of Christian institutions that provided hospital care, orphanage and education care, with a whole system of deacons and deaconesses under the care of the local bishop. And care was provided in that situation until life's natural end, even when cure was not possible. Augustine was probably the first person to write in detail about suicide and the end of life and related issues, and Augustine came to the view that suicide was not something that was allowed for Christians to do in any circumstance, with one exception, and the one exception was young Christian women who were at risk of being raped for their faith, and chose, I guess in that sense, death rather than dishonour. And that in the early church was probably the only exception that was really considered. And it continued down to the Middle Ages. So in the Middle Ages, Aquinas talked about the importance of living life to its natural end, that we weren't to take the place of God in deciding when life would end. In the Lateran Council, the Fourth Lateran Council in the 14th century, doctors and others who actively assisted people to die were placed under anathema. That is to say, they were executed in a spiritual sense, and certainly excommunicated, and to the extent that there was no option, to the Catholic Church in the 14th century, they were considered and placed outside of their understanding at that time of God's grace. The other thing that happened though in the Middle Ages was that physicians became organised into guilds for the first time. In the early 13th and 14th century, you start to see groups of guilds of physicians being recognised, and it was no longer possible just to call yourself a physician because your father had been a physician and you had some experience of the ancient arts. You actually had to be organised into guilds. The guilds were recognised by the church, and they operated according to the principles that the church laid down. And it is this point that you first start to see the understanding and the idea of the duty of care first appearing. And it's only in the 14th century that they say for the first time it was a physician's duty not to desert the care of hopeless people. 14th century, okay, awfully long time down the tracks before people were told as doctors that they were not to desert people whose cases appear hopeless. And the context was really interesting. The ethical question was, if you refuse to treat a poor person who cannot pay you and they have a severe illness and then they die, are you not in fact just as guilty of helping that person to die because you didn't treat them as if you did treat them with medications that cause them to die, which I know sounds complicated, but you can see where it's going. And in fact, in that period, there was a lot of attention given to the art of dying well. Ars moriendi, the art of dying well. And in fact, it's sad that the original use of the words that later became to be used in the sense of euthanasia actually relate to the art of dying well. And the art of dying well was to die in a state of grace, and before the Reformation that meant that you had confessed your sins at the last possible moment and received forgiveness. It meant that there was a doctor attending to you to try and make you as comfortable as possible. It meant that your family were around you, and that you had settled your affairs as best you could, and it meant that you died at home. And that view of a good way to die, in fact, continued in one form or another right through till about the 1950s. It's only in the last 50 years that a majority of people die in hospital rather than at home. And it's only in the last 50 years that a majority of people in Western culture anyway die in hospital, surrounded by nurses and doctors and maybe machines and various other things, rather than at home, surrounded by their family. And it's only in that period of time that technology's taken over. Well, after the Middle Ages came the Renaissance and the Reformation, and old classics were discovered, and the old philosophies of the lacking of value of human life were rediscovered. And at about the same time, the reformers were starting to speak clearly to the reality of what it meant to have a relationship with God, and therefore also what it meant to have a relationship with each other. And it is interest that a significant number of the reformers and the influential theologians in the early part of the Reformed era were very sick people. Now, this may actually be a manifestation of public health at the time. An average life expectancy was probably the order of 35, and you could tell a person's social status by the state of their teeth and how many they still had. But Martin Luther wrote that affliction, his personal affliction, was the best book in his library. Martin Luther wrote the hymn, "A Safe Stronghold Our God Is Still," Ein Fester Burg, after he recovered from an illness at the height of which for 3 hours his physician could not detect his vital signs. So he was either so unconscious, well, he was so unconscious he was only just breathing, and Martin Luther was a very large man, so maybe his heart was not palpable or something. But those reformers knew sickness that brought them to the very edge, and from which they recovered, nevertheless with a strong view that God did not allow them to determine the time of their death prematurely, that the time of death was in God's hands. Calvin took the view of Augustine and the earlier philosophers that we stay at the post that God calls us to until he calls us away. And so those of you who want to know the reference, it's in his Institutes, Book 4, Chapter 9, Part 3, Paragraph 5. Okay. Baxter, who was the Puritan rector of a small town in Gloucester beginning with K. Terrible. I remember faces really well and have terrible trouble. Kidderminster. Yes? Right. Yeah, thank you very much. He also spent a lot of his time, both himself sick and ministering to sick people, in his parish. And if you read The Reformed Pastor, which is one of those books that pastors should read to work out what's important, and the rest of us should read to work out what's important to let our poor pastors do, he speaks at great length about the importance of being with sick people and the importance that it is of the sick teach the well how to live, by which he meant that when you're really sick, a whole lot of things that matter when you're well don't really matter to anything like the same degree. When you're really sick, you work out what really matters, and that is, in the end, whether you're going to heaven or not. But also in the same period, for the first time, suicide was made a crime, and if a person suicided, the heirs were penalised. The estate of a suicide was confiscated and given to the crown. Why am I spending so much time talking about suicide? Because where we're going to in our own world today is not really euthanasia. Where people who talk about euthanasia are trying to get to is for the freedom for an individual person to be able to suicide, kill themselves at a time of their choosing, or more seriously, to request or even demand the support of a physician in doing that. Euthanasia, properly understood, in our culture is in fact a request for physician-assisted suicide. And that's what it is. It may be more than that, and we'll talk about the unfortunate experience of Holland and the Netherlands at the end of this talk, but physician-assisted suicide is what most people requesting euthanasia are in fact talking about. Well, the Enlightenment came along in the 18th century and new learning started to improve things very considerably. Physiology started to come along. People worked out that the blood actually circulated. You didn't produce indefinite amounts of it and suck up indefinite amounts of it. People started to improve pharmacology. Laudanum came along, first sort of pre-opiates, and improved physicians' ability to start to provide care for relief of suffering of patients in the 18th century. But with the Enlightenment came also atheist rationalists, and I guess the most prominent is David Hume, and he was the great atheist philosopher of the mid-18th century in England. And David Hume's greatest quote, the most memorable one on this aspect when he was talking about suicide and ending life, he said, "The life of a man is of no greater importance to the universe than that of an oyster." Which sounds awfully like something like Peter Singer would say, doesn't it? Awfully something like Peter Singer would say. Or for that matter, Pliny the Elder. David Hume's view of life was that people were entitled to live as long as they were usefully productive in life, and if the time came that they were not useful or productive in life, then they ought to be able to take their life and go away. At the same time, the early evangelicals were preaching in the revival, and Watts, Isaac Watts, the hymn writer and non-conformist minister in London, wrote a very long tract about the evils of suicide, and he noted that the only reason people were talking about it was because that they didn't have a view of the value of life, and it was much easier to have that view if you didn't believe in God and you didn't believe that you were likely punished for it. Wesley preached about the evil of suicide, in fact removing the opportunity for repentance forever. If a person ends their life for whatever reason, then obviously after that point they have no chance to come to God after that situation, and that was an observation that Aquinas had first made. Newton spoke against suicide as well, but Newton's experience was tempered somewhat by severe depression in his friend Cooper. Now, Newton and Cooper were two great hymn writers, and we only see a little bit of Newton in Amazing Grace when he's old and blind and wearing a hair shirt and at St Mary's Church in London, but for a good 20-something years before that, he was ministering in the countryside at Oney. And his friend Cooper, looking at the what we read of his life now, was clearly a manic depressive, and clearly went up and clearly went down, and when he was manic he wrote the most wonderful hymns. And when he was depressed he tried to jump in the river because he couldn't swim, and had to be rescued on a couple of occasions. And Newton really wrestled with the whole problem of melancholy in suicide. Blackstone, who was the great English jurist at the time, spoke about suicide in his Summary of Common Law in the mid-18th century, which I'm told by one of my legal friends is still the definitive group of tomes on the English common law. He spoke of suicide as being a double offence. It was a spiritual offence because the person who committed the offence burst in upon their maker before their time, and it was a temporal offence because of a homicide against the person, and it deprived that person, that person's family, of relationship and sustenance in life. Moving along to the 19th century, medical things advanced very considerably. Surgery started, initially traumatic surgery in war. They discovered the importance of hand washing in the mid-19th century, and unfortunately appears to have been forgotten in most public hospitals in the last 20 years in favour of antibiotics. They discovered and purified opium, and it became very freely available in the 19th century, and some of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's best poetry was written under the influence. They discovered chloroform, an early anaesthesia. And with each of these things coming along, Christians had two views. One was that, for example, the chloroform, that it shouldn't be used in childbirth because pain in childbirth was part of Genesis. And the rest of the Christians said no, relieving pain was good because pain in childbirth only followed after the fall, and who knows what childbirth would have been like before the fall. And same with opium and so forth. Nursing practice, as you know, was revolutionised by Florence Nightingale following wartime experience in the Crimea. And in the 19th century, a whole host of voluntary societies and church women's ministries sprang up. And one of the areas of work that they concentrated on was homes for the dying. And in fact, many of the institutions that we see in Australia, but also in Europe, had their origins in particularly church women's ministries and voluntary societies in the early 19th century. The Sisters of Charity, who run St. Vincent's, and various of that group were founded by a lady called Mary Aikenhead, who was born in Ireland at the end of the 18th century, interestingly, of a Protestant father and a Catholic mother, and was brought up a Protestant but converted to Catholicism after her father did so on his deathbed. Her father was a doctor, and she saw the suffering that was happening in Ireland. The Sisters of Mercy, likewise, an Irish nuns group. There were deaconess orders in Germany and in England that were set up in the 19th century for specific women's nursing ministries for people for the dying. And at the same time, in the mid-19th century, A.A. Hodge at Princeton and Spurgeon in London both developed quite acute theologies of suffering and relief of suffering as being in God's purpose and plan. And at least in Spurgeon's case, it came very much out of his personal experience of both severe physical suffering and at several times in his life, in Spurgeon's life, profound depression, very profound depression. But at the end of his life, Spurgeon wrote, and within the last 2 or 3 years, that in his experience and the experience of his friends, the sufferings that people underwent as they approached death and the support that Christians could give were, in his view, of inestimable value, which may seem quaint to us today, but I think there's some measure of truth in some of the things he says. Well, institutions for caring when there's no cure in New South Wales. The Sacred Heart Hospice in Darlinghurst was established in 1893. Interestingly, the congregation there established both St. Vincent's and Sacred Heart as interdenominational, and without particular religious focus, and got into trouble just before the turn of the century with their then Archbishop because they were providing Protestant Bibles in Sacred Heart instead of, or as well as, Douai Bibles, the Catholic version. At Ryde, the Home for Incurables was established in 1901, and it continues to this day on top of the hill as Wee Mala, part of the Royal Ryde, now the Royal Ryde Rehabilitation Centre. And the Home of Peace, which is my organisation, Hope Healthcare, was established at Petersham in 1907. And we celebrated our centenary last month, which is why you have centenary packs of those things. And each of these three institutions was established for those who were left homeless and suffering after hospital care. And many of those people had cancer, but by no means all. In fact, when you read through the admission documents, and we have all our admission books in Hope Healthcare, going right back to 1907. It's very interesting to see that in amongst, there's a lot of people with cancer, there's a lot of women with cancer of the cervix, there's a lot of men with cancer of the stomach. But in amongst the cancers, there are people who whose diagnosis is labelled as senile, people who've had profound strokes. So very much these institutions from the earliest period were looking at caring for people when there was no cure and not specifically just about cancer. What I'm going to do now is to have a look in the century since 1907 in parallel the development of our own local institution in Hope Healthcare and what's happened over that century, with what's happened in the background, legally and medically, with understanding of looking after people at the end of life. Our first hospice was opened in a cottage in Addison Road, Petersham, in 1907. It's actually very interesting. You can read the story in your book pack later on about how the Homes of Peace came to be established. But in brief, Archdeacon Langley, who was a great one in the Church of England around the turn of the century, went to visit somebody at Sacred Heart in 1906 who was dying. And this gentleman said to Archdeacon Langley, "Why does your church not have a ministry to those who are dying like this?" Because, you know, he couldn't get to read his Bible because they'd just been taken off the ward. Archdeacon Langley thought, well, that's a very good question, so he went and talked to another archdeacon whose name escapes me, but it's in the book, and who was in charge of Deaconess Ministries, and the pair of them stuck their heads together and thought, this is a good idea, and they called a meeting in April 1907, in the chapter house of St Andrew's Cathedral to establish a home for incurables. And they raised, one night in April 1907, £500. Now, £500 in 1907 would buy about a third of the value of a really decent house. So in today's terms, we're looking at, you know, a one-night meeting at Central Baptist Church or the chapter house or in the Lyceum Theatre or something, depending on your denomination, raising $300,000 out of people's pockets, bang, on the night. Really something. And they had bought their cottage before the end of the year. And it was very simple to start with. 6 beds, 1 matron, and the rest were just about all volunteers or deaconesses. They had 2 local GPs, who were the medical attendants, and they had 2 local parish ministers who used to come and visit. And that was how it started. And over the 20 years from 1907 to 1927, I'll sort of look at this in 20-year blocks, the cottage developed up from 6 beds to 26 beds, and eventually in 1923 they built quite a large building which housed 85 places. Now, in the same period of time, there was a great optimism after the First World War, because it was the war to end all wars. There wasn't going to be another war after that. Terrible things had happened, but there was peace. You know, the Germans had been defeated. The Christian Empire was triumphant. But there was also there was the economic depression that followed, but also at the same time, there were many people coming back with a terrible experience of war, where they had found that, and you read the writings of the period, you find many people saying that the chaplains and the religious experience of the time had let them down completely. People didn't have any answer to the carnage of Flanders. They didn't have any answer to what was happening on the Somme. They didn't have any answer to the fact that 20 and 30,000 men were mown down by machine guns in a day. And they weren't all killed. They weren't all killed. A lot of them were out, lying outside of the trenches, dying over 3 or 4 or 5, 6 days, begging to die. And in those days, if you were shot in the arm or leg, you lost an arm and leg and you lived. If you were shot anywhere else, you died. And it happened in the American Civil War, but it also happened in the battlefields of World War I, that many people who were severely wounded in the abdomen or the chest or somewhere where they wouldn't be able to live would beg their mates to put them down, to shoot them. And coming out of the period of the First World War, people started to develop, particularly those without Christian belief, started to develop a very determinist view of life that focused around things like eugenics, that said, well, people who were retarded or crippled or otherwise had mental illness at birth shouldn't be allowed to have families. And many states passed laws that allowed for involuntary sterilisation of people who had those illnesses. And in fact, in this state, as recently as 20 years ago, parents of children who were disabled could make a decision on their children's behalf at law in New South Wales to have their child sterilised. And there were societies that really got going on saying, well, if it's okay to do that in war, it ought to be okay to put a person out of their misery when they're suffering and to offer them euthanasia. And in the 1920s, there started to be a significant push towards voluntary euthanasia. Well, from the period from 1927 to 1947, the hospital buildings got bigger. We ended up with a plant of about 130 beds at Petersham. And after the war in the 1940s, we were no longer reliant totally on giving from church congregations. We weren't reliable on gifts of vegetables and fruit and meat from farmers. We accepted public funding from the government. And all of the hospices came within the purview of public hospital funding in the late 1940s. And over that period of time, things became more professional. There was more paid nursing staff, less voluntary nursing staff, full-time chaplains. So the medical staff were still very much volunteer GPs. Out in the medical world, in that period from 1927 to 1947, blood transfusion became a realistic thing. Cancer surgery and a whole range of quite major surgery became possible well before the period of antibiotics. Involuntary sterilisation, as I've noted, became legal in 38 out of 50 states in America, in most countries in Western Europe, and in many jurisdictions in Australia. But only Germany legalised euthanasia. Only Germany legalised euthanasia. And it actually happened initially just before Hitler came to power. The laws were very much broadened after Hitler came to power. And initially, euthanasia in Germany was legal for people who were disabled or retarded at any age. But as we know, what happened after that was that it was extended to gypsies and Jews and anybody in the end that didn't agree with the government. After the war, from the period 47 to 67, we expanded from one hospital to three, but our accommodation was still very much in multi-bed wards. Four beds or six beds all in together. And that was the kind of standard of care that was appropriate in the 1940s, 50s and 60s. In that period in the world outside, there was the rise of situation ethics. There was an American theologian, Episcopal theologian, James Fletcher, who reasoned that personhood was related intimately to a person's ability to reason, to understand their situation, to understand the gift that God was offering them in salvation, and to be able to make choices about that. And Fletcher's situation ethics, carried far enough, allowed him to argue that when a person could no longer reason, could no longer think for themselves, then they weren't fully a person. In the sense of having the ability to make decisions for themselves, and he argued therefore that a person in that situation could be allowed, had they indicated earlier, to choose euthanasia. There was a Bishop Robinson in England who wrote a book called Honest to God that some in this audience may remember reading. I think I remember reading my father's dog-eared copy. He developed situational ethics in all sorts of interesting ways, but certainly in terms of choice. And those folk in the Christian world were confronted by the neo-Orthodox, specifically Karl Barth, but also Carl Henry in the States. And in the English-speaking world, many of you will remember, I'm sure, reading Francis Schaeffer's earlier works. And before he was talking about abortion and the terrible things that that was going to do to American society, 10 years before that, he was talking about the terrible things that legalizing euthanasia was going to do to American society. The real milestone, though, in the development of care when there is no cure by a Christian was by a lady called Cecily Saunders and the development of the modern palliative care approach. Cecily Saunders was a most interesting lady. She was at Oxford University before the war, and she initially read arts, and she came under the influence of C.S. Lewis in that setting, and also Dorothy Sayers, who was a great Christian woman. Unfortunately, today is probably only best remembered for writing detective novels, but she did a whole lot of other things that were great in Christian terms. And Cecily Saunders, at the end of her time at Oxford, the war had just broken out, and she went to work as a nurse in Barts Hospital during the war. And terrible things were happening in London during the war with the Blitz and so forth, but she became acutely aware of the very special needs of those who were dying. After the war, she worked as a social worker, and then decided to go back and retrain as a doctor, with the aim specifically of developing care for the terminally ill. And in 1967, after working with people who were terminally ill for about 5 or 6 years, she was able to convince a group of people to cobble together enough funds, with support from a local parish church, to establish St. Christopher's Hospice in Sydenham, in London, in 1967. And it was the first of the modern hospices that actually looked specifically at the care needs of those who are dying when there is no possibility of cure. And it's fair to say that the modern concept of holistic palliative care dates from the time that St. Christopher's Hospice was opened and things were developed. She also was probably the first person very clearly to recognise that undiagnosed depression was at the root of most requests for euthanasia for people who were at the end of their life. Undiagnosed depression, often as a result of unresolved emotional and relationship issues. She's very strong on that. I met Cecily Saunders at the first Asia Pacific Hospice Congress in Singapore in 1996. She was very elderly. I believe that was the last time she travelled outside of England. I think she died the following year. And in one of the workshop discussions, this question was raised: what about palliative care and what about requests for euthanasia in a palliative care setting? And she said, well, in the 30 years to that point, we had treated more than 20,000 people at St. Christopher's, and St. Christopher's wasn't a very big hospice and only had quite a small sort of drawing area around it. I mean, by that stage it had been multiplied many hundreds of times in all sorts of other places in England. She said, in those 30 years, and with those 20,000 people, only 3 times had she had a request for euthanasia. Only 3. 2 were in hospital and 1 was at home. And in each case, when they really worked hard, they could find that there was both an unresolved emotional issue that was depressing the person, and there were physical symptoms that weren't properly being treated. And when those were dealt with, the request for euthanasia went away. So in the period from 67 to 87, within palliative care and within our own Hope Healthcare Institution, we moved from just a general care for indigent and people who had nowhere to live and no cure in the late 60s towards specialist units with medical and nursing staff who were particularly trained in those areas. And during those 20 years, as with many places, we moved away from being what I think today you would say is just being a general nursing home for people with incurable illness, to actually developing treatment plans and managing people's problems and helping them to live to the best possible extent for whatever number of days they still had of their life to live. The whole purpose of the kind of palliative care that Cecily Saunders was talking about was you can't add days to life, but you can add life to days. And that was one of her one of the things that she spoke about most clearly and most frequently, and it's certainly the case. But in the same period, through the late 60s and the 70s and the early 80s, there was a very significant rise in the world generally of life prolonging technology, okay, ventilator technology, whereby if a person stopped breathing because they had a severe brain injury, you could put a tube down their throat, you could hook them up to a machine, and the machine would breathe for them and breathe for them and breathe for them and breathe for them, and they'd keep going. Dialysis machines. It seems incredible to think, but 40 years ago, nobody had access to dialysis. Now, every jolly teaching hospital has got 5, 10, 15 chairs that are used in rotation, and an awful lot of people have got them in their home, and they turn them on, and they plug them in, and off they go. So, in the old days, people with inoperable and incurable renal failure, before the mid-1970s, most of them died. And before the mid-1980s, most of them didn't have access to it. Also, in the 70s and 80s, the current generation of really powerful drugs that allowed for life-prolonging technology to work appeared. Modern antibiotics, which in the old days before those, meant that if you're on a ventilator, you'd die of a chest infection. Even if the ventilator kept going because the chest infection would get you, the antibiotics came along and stopped it. Okay, medications to keep blood pressure up from off the floor came along, and you could keep a person's blood pressure up, you could ventilate them, you could dialyze them, you could do all those things and keep them going and going and going. And people started to worry that there was a real risk of inappropriate use of life prolonging technology. And there was a very famous case, I think in 1974, the Karen Quinlan case, that many of you will be able to remember. Karen Quinlan was a young lady who went to a party in the swinging 70s and consumed, they were never quite sure what she'd consumed, but it was sufficient to stop her breathing for a prolonged period of time, as a result of which she arrived at hospital unconscious and not breathing, and they put her on a ventilator. And after some months on the ventilator, Karen's parents approached the Supreme Court of New Jersey to ask for permission to turn the ventilator off, because they were arguing that the ventilator was not in fact prolonging life, it was in fact prolonging the person's dying. Their argument was that without the ventilator the person would clearly die, and they argued that there should be a right to stop undue support of life and a right to allow the person to die. Now, the whole question of rights in the American legal system is very interesting, and if you're a constitutional lawyer, which I'm not, it all hangs around the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment was something that was produced after the Civil War to guarantee the rights and choices of freed slaves, and it guaranteed them a whole range of rights, and it has been taken more generally to guarantee rights to the general American population. And the first of these extra rights this was in the context of, you know, Mississippi burning and all the human rights things that were going on in the Johnson presidency and so forth in the 60s and through to Nixon's time in the 70s. And they approached the court to say that Karen should have a right to die, basically, a right to die without having her dying process prolonged. The courts took, I think, 2.5 years to make a decision. And when Karen Quinlan's parents went to the Supreme Court and the decision was finally handed down, the Supreme Court said, well, we agree with you, there is this right. And they said, now, but she's on a ventilator and she's receiving nutritional support to a tube, do you want both of them cut off? And the parents, who were in fact strong Catholics, said, no, we don't want the feeding cut off, because that is nutrition and that's part of every person's life. we do want the respirator stopped because that's not a normal part of life. That's what's keeping it going. And the court said, all right, you may do it. And does anybody know what happened when they turned the ventilator off? She started to breathe and she lived for 9 years. She lived for 9 years. And in fact, the Quinlan case very clearly established, although it wasn't finally confirmed by the American legal system for another 10 years later, the difference between stopping onerous treatment that was in fact potentially prolonging a person's dying process on the one hand, as against actually actively doing something to bring about a person's death on the other. That is to say, stopping feeding them or giving them a medication that would kill them. So it's an important case to this day. And I vividly remember it happened when I was a fourth year medical student, and we used to have wonderful discussions about it. Well, where have we gone in the last 20 years? Well, in the last 20 years, we've swung away from hospital care, thank goodness. We've gone back to aged care residences and community care services. But particularly in the last 20 years, there's been a huge increase in Australia in nursing homes. Okay, cast your mind back 25 and 30 years. How many nursing homes were there? Nothing like the number there are now, okay? I drive down Forest Road a couple of times a week to come into the university, and without trying hard, I pass 5 nursing homes on my way, okay? And you can multiply that wherever you are in Sydney. And I have to tell you that 20 years ago, there was only one nursing home on that route. Not only that, the community support services that exist to care for older people and disabled people in their home are extraordinarily greater in their range now than they were 20 years ago. There's a swing back towards providing care for people in residential care and living at home. And within our organisation and Hope Healthcare and within palliative care and chronic care hospitals generally elsewhere in New South Wales, we've now differentiated into specific teams that look after, if you like, incurables in 3 major areas. The first is those who have a physical disability that's not going to get better, but we teach those people to live with that physical disability. Okay, whether it's a stroke or whether it's multiple fractures or whether it's a spinal injury or a head injury or an amputation, whatever it is. With palliative care, that's predominantly people with cancer, but not completely. People who clearly have an illness that's moving along a trajectory that will lead to their death. Specialist care teams in that area. And the third area that's developing and continuing to grow is aged care psychiatry. The people who've got significant problems with dementia or other psychiatric problems of old age that are just not going to get better. And the care is multidisciplinary, and we now offer it on 4 sites. Out in the world generally, arising from the experience of Quinlan and various other cases like it, there used to be a thing called an ordinary old power of attorney, which meant that when you went overseas you could give somebody whom you trusted with your life, because you're about to trust them with your bank account, you could trust them to operate your financial affairs on your behalf. And that was extended to what's called a durable power of attorney in this state and in most jurisdictions in Australia, whereby somebody else has got the power to make decisions in treatment on your behalf. There is, however, with a durable power of attorney, where your own interests before the event that incapacitated you overtakes you, if there was no clear idea that you did want something or you didn't want something in particular circumstances, the expectation of a durable power of attorney is that it is still exercised in the direction of preservation of life. That's the assumption underlying it. In the same period of time, the WHO established very clear standards for pain control. And those of you that have had anything to do with palliative care or pain control in a medical or nursing sense will know about the famous 3-step ladder, which starts with Panadol, goes to codeine, and ends up at morphine. As you have progressively more severe pain and you add things, and it's very well established how you treat pain, and it is possible to give very good control of pain in nearly every circumstance. There is really very little reason why, except in very rare circumstances, why in the year of grace 2007 that anybody should die with untreated pain. There is no reason for it. And there's a whole range of other symptoms for which medications are now well established and well available. It's only in the last 15 years that we have had good drugs for control of depression. Okay, it's only in the last 15 years, starting with Prozac and running through the other really good antidepressants, it's only in the last 15 years we've had those drugs. It's only in the last 15 years that we've had good drugs for control of nausea and hiccup. And those people who have intractable nausea and hiccup at the end of their lives will tell you that it's just as bad as having untreated pain at the end of your life to have those symptoms. And it's only in the last 15, 20 years that we've had good drugs and good treatment protocols to know how to use the drugs properly to relieve those symptoms properly. The problem with opium and morphine and all the rest of it is that it has to be given regularly and before the pain comes back. The old way of giving painkillers was you'd give a dose of painkiller, the pain would go away, you'd wait until the pain came back and then you'd give another dose. Not how it's supposed to be done. If you know the pharmacology of morphine, if it's not a long-acting preparation, basically it lasts in the system about 4.5 to 5 hours if you haven't got bad renal failure and kidney failure. And because it lasts in the system every 4 or 5 hours, you therefore need to give regular doses about every 4 hours, so the next dose is already in the system before the last dose has worn off. It sounds obvious, but such was the fear of opiate addiction, and I remember it even in my early days as a resident, that we were told don't give painkillers until the pain comes back because you'll make the person addicted. Garbage. Absolute garbage. I've got patients, and I do have pain patients in my rehab practice, who take doses of morphine that would euthanize me if I was given them. But they're taking hundreds of milligrams of dose of morphine to control their pain, and they're still wide awake and they're still driving their car. And yes, it's quite safe to drive the car in that part of Prairie Wood where they live without hitting a severely affected driver, simply because that's the dose that they need to blanket those pain control receptors. Okay, I only need 5 or 10 milligrams, I guess, if I get a really bad cut or a broken leg, to blanket my receptors, because my receptors are not upregulated by the experience of pain. But it's in that last 20 years we've had very good drugs for control of those symptoms. However, the humanists and those who are seeking final euthanasia are still trying, and the final right that they have tried to establish, and appears fortunately in both the states and here to establish, is the right to be killed, so-called. The right to physician-assisted suicide. And they talk about euthanasia, they talk about good deaths, but in fact what they're talking about is either suicide or physician suicide. There was a referendum in Oregon in the early 1990s that passed by a 1% margin that said that physicians could, if they were asked, assist their patients to die. There was a pathologist. He was never a practicing physician until he gained notoriety as a euthanasiarist, called Jack Kevorkian in Minnesota, who used to go around the place until he was finally put in jail. He used to go around the place with a van that was specially fitted out for physician-assisted suicide, and he used to pull up in front of people's houses that wanted it and chuff in there and give them either a cocktail or hook them up to an injection machine that contained various lethal cocktails and do the deed. Then he'd ring up the police station, report what he'd done, hop in the car and drive off before they arrested him across to the next jurisdiction. Our own Northern Territory, you will recall, legislated in favour of euthanasia, legislated in physician-assisted suicide, and the advocate was the strongest advocate in Northern Territory was a local doctor up there, Dr. Nitschke. The reason, I think, that the Northern Territory legislation got up was that there was no palliative care service in Darwin. There was not a decent palliative care service in Darwin until about 10 years ago. And that's why it got up. Now, the federal government overrode it, and they did also provide for a palliative care service, And it's worth remembering that when the Northern Territory legislation went through, the Aborigines in particular fought against it very, very strongly, because they said, if you can euthanize, then where's it going to stop? Because there were people in that community that had memories of other forms of euthanasia with people with guns in the 1920s and the 1930s. Finally, in 1997, the US Supreme Court upheld that there was no constitutional right in the United States to physician-assisted suicide. They upheld laws that were present in something like 35 states against physicians assisting with suicide, and one of the reasons that they gave was the ability of people to control symptoms of suffering at the end of life with palliative care, because from Cicely Saunders' first hospice in the 1960s in the UK, in the 1970s particularly, and into the early 1980s, there was a huge mushrooming of palliative care and hospices in America, and a lot of it done by Christian organisations. And the American government thought this was a great thing, because to be eligible for a hospice program, you have to remove yourself from the Medicare program. And if you remove yourself from the Medicare program, then you're no longer eligible to be admitted to expensive hospitals and have expensive treatment. You go into a hospice program and you have supportive treatment. And so the government supported it financially, and the court said that ethically and constitutionally and morally it was the right way to go. Well, the palliative care choice, I take it now, in Australia is very well established in progressive incurable disease. But what of non-cancer diseases? What if people with Alzheimer type dementia? Far more of those out in the community than with cancer. And make no mistake, Alzheimer's disease is just as fatal an illness as lung cancer. It just takes much longer to get there. It does take much longer to get there. 7 years? 10 years. But you get there in the end. Alzheimer's may start with memory problems, but it ends up with a combination of memory problems, incontinence, mobility problems, and people who are severely affected in the end stage of their disease lie in bed and can do nothing. People with multiple strokes, there are large numbers of frail, dependent elderly people out there with high cost care. What happens if you don't protect those people? There is a worked example, and it's in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, to this day, euthanasia and assisted suicide are both illegal by statute law. However, in 1963, a physician who euthanized her mother, who was suffering with cancer, was taken to court in the jurisdiction in Leeuwarden, and in that jurisdiction, the local court fashioned an exception to the law, and the exception to the law was that if a person was suffering with a terminal illness from which there was no escape, it was excusable for the physician to end their life. In 1984, the matter came to court again in the town of Alkmaar, which sadly has got one of the largest and best preserved Dutch Reformed churches in town, to which about 50 people go every Sunday. It's got a very, very fine pipe organ indeed from the 17th century. And in that town, the guidelines under which physicians were allowed to euthanize patients were defined. And they were defined as allowing people to euthanize people who asked to be put out of their pain. By 1995, in the Netherlands, in a national survey, more than 50% of all doctors had practiced euthanasia at some point in the last year or two in their medical practice. And many of the episodes that they had practiced were involuntary. That is to say, they were not with the request or the permission of the patient, because the patient could not give that permission or could not do that request. Indeed, in one particularly awful case, they did a survey and a doctor said, talking about his practice 6 months earlier, I ended the life of a Catholic nun who was in such pain and confusion that I knew with her religious belief she would not ask me for euthanasia, but I ended her suffering anyway. That's what happens when there is no care, when there is no cure. The Netherlands, unfortunately, has gone back to its pre-Christian status in many places as being a pagan Roman colony next to the North Sea with the same view of human life. In fact, in a country of 12 million, it's estimated in the Netherlands now that less than 200,000 people go to church regularly. It's probably the most unchurched country in Europe, which is really sad when you think of all the wonderful Reformed theology that came out of the Netherlands 200 or 300 years ago. Palliative care in Australia is a clear option for the care of people with cancer and motor neurone disease and so forth, and other progressive neurological problems in Australian culture. We know about palliative care, we expect palliative care. It is practiced in all our hospitals, not only in the Christian and the Catholic institutions, but also in the secular public institutions. Palliative care is practiced, and in this country, people are not euthanized. But I ask you to think, what about dependent elderly people in nursing homes? The real cost to the taxpayer of maintaining an elderly person in skilled, high-level nursing care in this country is around $38,000 per annum. They don't pay that. That's the cost of the Commonwealth Government subsidy. Now, I have to tell you that when you have an older person who's in a nursing home and is swallowing up a fair bit of money in their care, and you have anxious family in the next generation who have financial issues, who have care issues, who have problems, that it is awfully easy for people not to think clearly. In the Netherlands, only church-run nursing homes do not allow euthanasia. People from church-run nursing homes who go to public hospitals usually now have a tag around their neck that says, "Do not euthanize me," in the public hospitals. I submit to you that in the next generation, the next 5, 10, 15 years, it is critical in Australia that Christians are in this place of caring for people when there is no cure, and the big area coming over the horizon is nursing home care. There are nursing homes in all of the places where you live. There are people who are church members who are now in nursing homes. Do you visit them? Do you talk to them? Do you go and provide comfort, even if they're forgetful and they can only remember hymns with words from 50 years ago and they can only understand the King James Version, not all the wonderful things that we have now? Do you go? Do you provide a ministry in those places? Because it is critical that Christians are in that place. In talking about Christian ministry to older people and looking at things in the Bible, there is a piece of scripture that isn't often considered in this category, and it's when Paul is talking about the body and the squeaky old tent in 1 Corinthians, I think, chapter 4. This is not on the slides, but I'll give you an extra 2 or 3 minutes on this because I think it's apposite. He talks about it's 2 Corinthians, sorry. He talks about him being in his ministry in treasures in jars of clay. You know, the difficulty that he's really not a very strong person and God's given this this great ministry to him. And a lot of people think about chapter 4 and chapter 5 in terms of ministry. They don't actually think about it in terms of Paul, the person. Because I have to say, at the time that Paul wrote this, he was a geriatric crumble. He was probably in his late 50s. and the person in their late 50s in the ancient world would look much more like a person in their 80s now. Or, if you go to indigenous community, a person in their late 50s in an indigenous community that has not had the kind of health care we have now. So Paul says, we do not lose heart, though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day. He talks about looking to things seen, the things unseen. But then he says at the beginning of chapter 5, we know that if the tent which is our heavenly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. People say, great, look at that verse, think ahead to the future, think about your new body, you're going to get rid of this old body eventually. And a lot of the preaching on these passages is about what's coming later. Paul, in fact, is talking about now. He says, in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we would be further unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up in life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as guarantee. Paul's view is that the real person is inside the groaning tent. Okay? The groaning tent. I don't know if any of you guys ever went on beach mission, but where do tents groan in the high wind? They groan where they've been badly sewed together. I remember the one at Hat Head was in that category. They groan where the poles are. They groan where the structure's not really good, and yet the people inside are preserved. That is a picture of people that are still in God's image. The outside may be groaning. The outside may be crumbly. The outside may be grey, wrinkly, not remembering, whatever. But inside, there is still a person that is made in the image of God. And that is the reason that we provide care when there is no cure. I'm sorry to have gone so long.